This is Alex. I'm from Boston.
Hello, this is Jackie, and I'm from Houston.
Hey, this is Rahul from Stanford.
And we are the Premier Chefs.
Hey guys, the Premier Chels is sponsored by Kickoff Coffee. They are a top quality artisanal roasted coffee. In other words, they're Champions League winner and Premier League winner every single time. They deliver fresh bags directly to your home, so you don't have to go to a coffee shop and pick up something. And the best part about them is every bag gives back to soccer charities. 10% of the proceeds go to organizations that use soccer to promote youth social development in the underserved areas. Use our code TPCOFFEE15 to get 15% off your order. You can order at kickoffcoffeeco.com or check out the links on our social media. Thanks.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to the Premier Chelsea, your source for all things Premier League, but starting with Chelsea first. Coming to your speakers and headsets, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I'm one of your hosts, Jackie, and today I'm actually joined by a good friend of the podcast, Ben Jacobs. Ben, welcome back.
Good to be back, Jackie. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. It's been a while since we've chat with you, but we're excited to have you back on. There's a lot of interesting things going on this January, and I think I just want to kick it off with some non-Chelsea information, and I'm very curious about this one, Ben. It is Jordan Henderson leaving the Saudi League. So I know in the summer when he moved over, there was a lot of talk of how this is a long-term project and he was going to go grow the sport. It seems we've heard different things that are going on, so it'd be nice to hear any updates that you have about the situation.
Yeah, very interesting story, and one of the stories, I suppose, of the transfer window. And in essence, I think it's a mixture of things. Naturally, Henderson didn't settle in Saudi on or off the field, but at the same time, we can't pin that all on the club because maybe he should have done his due diligence. It's not one of the PIF-controlled ones. It's a very friendly and accommodating club with big plans, with a new stadium that's just been built. So flash forwards maybe in the next three or four seasons, and Al Ittifaq, whether under Steven Gerrard or somebody else, will be, I think, a very serious club and one that is going to showcase quite neatly what this Saudi project is about between either now and 2030 or, of course, the World Cup in 2034. And it takes time to build culture and fan base outside of some of the bigger clubs like Al Hilal, for example. And at the same time, when you've opened a new stadium, new training facilities and all of this, it can be very difficult to just get overnight success. So the foundations are being built at Al Ittifaq, but I'm not sure that Henderson at his age wanted to wait, despite saying that it's a long-term project. And you expect that kind of messaging and those words from players. But the reality of the situation is that Henderson needed something immediate because he's heading towards a summer where he'll be playing in his last Euros. And with Conor Gallagher, if we are tying it to Chelsea, with Curtis Jones as well, maybe, just maybe, he started to feel that his England place was not as secure as when he first moved to Saudi Arabia and got guarantees from Gareth Southgate that the move in itself wouldn't undo his chances of selection. And that's one aspect, the football side. And then naturally, there's the family element. His family was living in Bahrain. Henderson had a base there with them, but also one in Saudi Arabia. The weather also is a factor because it changes the football games to later. And in the first 2 months, it was stifling heat, 40 degrees, then 9 o'clock kickoffs, trainings at night as well. So you've basically got to go from being Liverpool captain in a Premier League routine to flipping everything towards nighttime and getting used to a new culture, a new language, and a developing project. So when you then spell that out, in hindsight, maybe Henderson should have taken more time to do his due diligence. I'm still really staggered that players, when they choose an emerging league, we saw it in China as well, don't take the time to fly over there and view the facilities. Messi, when he was considering Saudi Arabia, did exactly that. Ronaldo did the same. But 9 transfers out of 10, the player goes, and we shouldn't be naive about it. Money is a factor. And then they get there and they understand what the training facilities are like, where they're going to live, how big the stadium is, what the standard's like. And I just think more needs to be done before. Otherwise, you run into this eventuality. So Henderson was able to terminate his contract. And because he deferred his wages for half a season and the annual gross wage was 8 million and that was tax-free, but because he hasn't stayed for 2 years, there are now tax implications. But the sort of bottom line is he didn't take the majority of his wage, worth for half a season, $4 million. Having deferred that, he then decided not to claim that. And that helped create a termination because Al Ittifaq feel like they've essentially saved $4 million and then they've been able to free up the other $4 million in the second half of the season. And that's allowed them to move in the market. And also the transfer fee, which is widely reported as $12 million. And there are sources that brief that, but Ittifaq and Saudi sources say that the transfer fee was also only $4 million. So you could kind of argue that Henderson came for $4 million, surrendered $4 million in wages, and those two offset each other. And then it frees up $4 million in the second half of the season that also allows Al Ittifaq to move for other players in the market. So in the end, I think that it was a termination that suited all parties. It's a shame that it didn't work out, but I don't think that we can lay the blame on the Saudi Pro League. It's very easy to scapegoat the league, but we have to understand that despite all these big names, the infrastructure is going to take time to catch up with the ambition. And if players don't realize that and move blindly for money and other perks, or because maybe they genuinely do want to be part of something at ground level, they have to understand that in Henderson's case, for example, it was always going to be a massive jump down from being Liverpool captain to being Al Ittifaq captain. So you've either got to relish that and mentor other players and be patient, or you've got to choose not to make the move because it's not right for you, even if the money is fantastic. And I think in Henderson's case, he was in a difficult position because at the turn of the year, his team hadn't won since October, mid-table, and also didn't have a game between the Christmas period and still at the time of recording now. Their next game will be the 15th of February, I believe. So you've also got 6 weeks when Gareth Southgate's going to be watching others, assessing their form, trying to lock in maybe his final squad as early as possible. You've got Curtis Jones, as I said before, and Conor Gallagher in excellent form, and Henderson wasn't playing. So I suspect that a big part, regardless of the Saudi aspect and the standard aspect, I think a big part of Henderson's desire to leave and so quickly was very selfish and was very much about ensuring that by playing regularly for Ajax, he stands a chance of selection for Euro 2024.
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic. And as I listen to it, I almost wonder, Ben, and I don't know if this is a case, does this kind of sour the Saudi Pro Leagues into getting some of these players that are maybe at the end of their playing time and they're looking to maybe transition just for money? Or is it one of those where they're like, okay, the relationship didn't go the way we wanted, but there's nothing that's going to burn the bridges here?
Well, I think that it's sort of a paradox because right now the Saudi Pro League need these players in their late 20s through to mid 30s, and they're prepared to pay big money. But if we look at 3 or 4 seasons ahead, each window, or certainly each season, the average age of signings will probably drop. And that's because as the league improves, you can go from having a 33-year-old to maybe attracting a 30-year-old to maybe getting more 25-year-olds. And that's just because the standard would rise. And if the money stays the same, each season it becomes a more lucrative move, potentially, because if you're at your peak, you can ask for more. And a more appealing move because the infrastructure, as I said before, starts to catch up with the ambition. So this is why I think we have to be patient with the Saudi Pro League. I don't think Henderson's exit is particularly damning simply because it was a very unusual set of circumstances, not one of the PIF clubs, a family decision, an England-related decision. And also we saw a summer of 94 foreign signings. So the fact that 3, 4, 5, 6, however high profile, are unhappy is no real reflection on the wider Saudi strategy. It just shows you that maybe the clubs move too fast, maybe the players move too fast, maybe there was just such a big volume that you would expect statistically players to be unhappy. And we don't see people saying, oh, English football, the Premier League is rubbish, it's unsettling because there's too many games, because the weather's cold, because the team a player joined have not got Champions League football. We see players stick it out. And the reason for that is obviously because the Premier League is the best league in the world at the moment. So nobody's debating the standard, which means somehow if a player's unhappy, it's more on them they've not acclimatized, they've not settled, but you got given the chance to play at the very highest level and get compensated for it. So therefore, when a player's unhappy, especially if they've made a move, if their reasoning is didn't like the weather, didn't like the food, couldn't grasp the language, et cetera, we don't kind of go, wow, the club or the Premier League didn't do enough to integrate them. We just say every so often that happens and not every move works out. But when one move doesn't work out in the Saudi Pro League, it snowballs. So then people say, well, Henderson's unhappy, Jota's unhappy, Benzema's unhappy. And before you know it, there's this wave of media headlines that suggest, I think a little wrongly, that the whole project is going to fall to pieces. And again, I'm not saying that players are unhappy or happy. I'm just saying that in too many cases, players haven't done their due diligence. So if it was a case of the Saudi deal makers breaking their promises, saying you're going to live here, you're not. Saying it's going to be like this, it isn't. Saying that you're going to get paid this, you're not. That's a different story. But if it's a case of players arriving and then after the buzz and after the first few paychecks, suddenly thinking, yikes, this standard is not what I expected. These facilities are not what I expected. Well, guess what? You could have watched a video before you went. You could have made a trip over there. You could have toured the facilities. So I've little or no sympathy for a player that takes a move without doing their due diligence. And I have every sympathy for the Saudi project from a football perspective, only in the sense that from day one, and I mean day one, it was made abundantly clear that this is going to grow between now and 2030, which is the vision year. So Vision 2030 has got a sports strategy. That's partly why it's being funded centrally. It's all about creating buzz, creating lifestyle, creating jobs, not relying on oil and gas, and bringing sport to Saudi Arabia to ultimately infuse a very young population. And the Saudi Pro League is a part of that. So if we're judging the league after one summer or half a season, that feels a little bit unfair. And if players are judging Saudi Arabia or anywhere they move to after only 6 months, maybe that's a bit unfair too, especially, as I say, if they didn't actually go and do their research. I've lived out in the Middle East, and I originally was in the UAE, and it's very Western in Dubai. And it probably still took me a year to acclimatize, because when you first go there, you're like, wow, get used to the climate. Then get used to the language, even though luckily in Dubai, it's very Western and more people speak English. But I also moved to Qatar. I've been in Bahrain. I visited Saudi Arabia. So I've been in enough places to realize that it's tricky that first 6 months. And it was only really a year, personally and professionally, when I thought, I understand the lay of the land. So a footballer, I think it's different because it's so extreme to go from morning training to evening training, from English weather to Saudi weather. My job obviously wasn't involving outdoor or exercise. So the climate wasn't really something that became a means to complain. But the point I'm making is, if any of us are judging something after 6 months, then maybe that's not even enough time. And then if the Saudi deal makers are saying that their project needs not 6 months, but maybe 6 years before we should judge it, then I think we have to take that into account. So it's very easy to create headlines, and there will be some unhappy players. And naturally, if Benzema was to go as well, or N'Golo Kante, then it would be worrying for the deal makers, because you don't know who might after that follow, or who may reject the move because they actually only wanted to come and be a teammate of Benzema and Kante, or a teammate of Cristiano Ronaldo. So that's a factor as well with some of these star names. But in essence, it's so early in the Saudi project that I don't think Henderson's departure is going to derail anything.
Yeah, and I appreciate you actually comparing it to the Premier League. And I think it's easy for our listeners and for me, Ben, as a longtime Premier League follower, to make that jump and say, yeah, the Premier League's been around for a long, long time. And we've heard stories of players coming in from South America and not able to settle to English weather and not able to settle to English food and language. And so it's nice to have that comparison, because it actually builds that connection that we're looking for when we are trying to interpret who's wrong. And ultimately, I think based on everything you've said, no one is wrong. It's just a relationship that doesn't seem to suit all parties. And I'm glad it ends in a good way for Jordan Henderson and the Saudi League. Like you said, we'll move on from here and kind of go on and recruit some more players and make it work. Ben, I want to transition from the Saudi League, but stick with a Liverpool connection, I guess, and We've all heard the buzz in the news about Jurgen Klopp saying he is going to be leaving Liverpool at the end of the season. It's a big one because I think in the Premier League the last decade, he's been a successful manager. He's been a name that's been there week in, week out. And it took me by surprise, but I want to get your feedback and maybe something you've heard, or was it a surprise to you as well?
Well, it was a surprise to us, but not to Liverpool, the fan base, naturally, but not those within the ownership and the senior leadership team. And that says it all about Liverpool, their planners. And with a League Cup final against Chelsea and mid-season before the real business end kicks in, I think it was quite smart to announce it. Otherwise, there's always a danger that it becomes a distraction. And right. The closer you announce it towards the end of the season, the more clamour there will be. And also, in addition to that, the more there's likely to be a side narrative around the replacement. Because right now, Klopp can announce it and Liverpool can formally start their recruitment search. And they'll do it discreetly. But there's always a chance that something comes out. And if they can get a replacement done early, you draw a line under it. Whereas if you were to announce Klopp was leaving later, then it could either leak and then the timescale is out of your control, or alternatively, the Liverpool fan base starts panic a little bit, because what if you announce Klopp was going in April or May? Then it's like, who's going to be in charge for the summer? And how does that affect everything? Optics, recruitment, and so on. So I think this is Liverpool being calm and smart. And the timing makes a lot of sense because it looks like it's going to galvanize the teams. It's not great news for Chelsea ahead of the League Cup final because that's their first opportunity to win a trophy. And now the players who learnt about it a bit later than the ownership and the senior leadership team are even more, I think, determined to go out on a bang. And it won't quite be the same kind of quadruple that Liverpool were challenging for a couple of seasons ago. But the one that Klopp hasn't won is the Europa League. So if they can somehow get four trophies, then obviously bad news for Chelsea in terms of the League Cup. But it would be an incredible story. And I think that Liverpool are going to take some stopping, even though Manchester City's form in the Premier League is looking ominous. I think Liverpool's owners knew about this in November, so they have had plenty of time to formulate a succession plan. And what Liverpool always do well is make sure that they take considered decisions. And when everyone else is ranting and raving, we saw this over the summer, why didn't Liverpool go for Bellingham? How did Liverpool bid 100 million plus for Caicedo and still not get him? How did they miss out on Caicedo and not get Lavia? But the reality of the situation is they got Ryan Gravenberch, who they actually wanted before he'd gone to Bayern Munich. They got Dominic Szoboszlai, who has been excellent when he is fit. They got Alexis McAllister, a World Cup winner, an absolute steal, one of the bargains, financially speaking, of the summer. And they got Endo, who everyone moaned about, but actually the Liverpool fan base are now warming to him. And when Endo isn't playing, everyone's saying, we really could do with Endo at the moment. So that feels like a pretty good midfield revamp to me. And if you compare that to everything Liverpool do, it's the same. You've got the noise against Liverpool. You've got the narrative of everybody's leaving. They lost their sporting director as well. Dr. Ian Graham had left their head of data. But quietly, professionally, discreetly, and sensibly, Liverpool work behind the scenes to plan windows ahead. And they'll have a succession plan for Klopp. And I fully expect the next manager to be able to build on his legacy. So this isn't about having to make wholesale changes, tactical changes, structural changes, foundational changes, identity changes, like with Chelsea. Every single change between Abramovich and Clearlake Boley, between Tuchel to Potter, and then Potter to Pochettino, everything strategically felt a little bit flip-floppy. And what ties it together is the model, but the model doesn't succeed if there's a manager coming in every 3 to 6 months, if the players are young, if there's no real identity, if there's no passages of play, if there's no personality, if there's no leadership. So this is what Pochettino is trying to fix. If you look at Liverpool, there'll always be a transition, and Klopp's been there long enough, 9 years, that whoever comes in is going to inherit that. So it won't be a case of starting again. It will be a case of building on what he's built. And that's why I think that Liverpool will be unconcerned. And naturally, Xabi Alonso is one name to watch. I think that Roberto De Zerbi will be in contention. Some say Ange Postecoglou, but he's still very new to Spurs. He is, it's understood, a Liverpool fan, though. Julian Nagelsmann might be a candidate, although we know that when Chelsea looked, they weren't that sort of impressed by the man management side of things, even though he's a top, top coach. I think that Thomas Tuchel's hinted that he might not stay at Bayern for that long. More are linking him at the moment with Barcelona rather than Liverpool. And I think that's fair. I'd be surprised if Tuchel came back to the Premier League with Liverpool, although it does sound like he's got a point to prove and he's not going to be able to prove that point with Chelsea. So you can never say never. But I don't think Liverpool will be short of options. It's a very well-run club. And it looks like whoever's going to inherit the Klopp job will do so, unlike with Chelsea, with everything at a real high, with the midfield revamp complete. And then they'll probably look to do a defensive revamp, still maybe bring in a striker, especially if Salah goes. But whoever takes that job might inherit a team that's won potentially four trophies. So it's an amazing job to come into. There'll be pressure, naturally, but I think the foundations at Liverpool are really, really strong. So I think that they'll be able to cope with life without Klopp.
Ben, it's one of those that is bittersweet for us as Chelsea fans. I guess bitter because you've mentioned some things of they want to go out on a high and we're trying to compete for a trophy, but sweet because he has been a thorn in our side for a very, very long time. Jurgen Klopp is still only 56 in terms of managerial age. That's relatively young. He can still go on, in my opinion, for at least another decade. He cited stress maybe as one of the reasons he may want to leave. Is there something behind the scenes that has broken down between the relationship of Liverpool's ownership and Klopp, or is it truly he's been doing this for a long time and needs to take a little bit of a break?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. Klopp's had a great relationship with Mike Gordon, with Billy Hogan, the CEO, and it's a collaborative model. He knows what he's in for. Nothing's really changed between Klopp and FSG from day one, and he understands his role within the model, and they have a very personal relationship alongside a professional one. So I think these suggestions that something broke down over the summer, leading to him informing the club that he didn't want to stay on in November, are incorrect to my understanding. The summer was difficult because there was a lot of speculation, but it ended ultimately with Liverpool keeping on to Mo Salah. And yes, they didn't get Caicedo, but that's not really Liverpool's fault. They were maybe a bit late into that battle, but they still bid 100 plus million and got an offer accepted. If the player says no, you can't really pin that on the club.
Right.
And I think that Klopp understands the reality. He knows that he's not always been able to move freely in the market, but you also have to counter that with adding up the money he has been able to spend. So sometimes when a manager says that, they don't get their target, they wish that they had the Chelsea billion to spend, it can be a bit misrepresentative because Klopp has not had to reach behind the sofa in the Liverpool break room to find money needed. Klopp was ultimately able to be backed in the market across his 9 years. And even when he didn't get Caicedo, they still put that money down. And by losing out on Caicedo, they spent money elsewhere. Szoboszlai wasn't cheap either. And I'm sure that in the summer after Klopp leaves, there'll be a couple of hundred million to spend as well. So I don't think we can paint Liverpool and Klopp as paupers. And I also think that Klopp appreciates that, which is why I don't see any, talking to sources, falling out between the ownership group and Klopp. I think this is just about a realization that it's hard being a manager. It takes a lot of time and energy. It's a 24/7 job. You're dining off your results. You're judged on your failures. And once you get into your mid-50s, it's tiring. And that's why I think that Klopp will be genuine in taking a year-long break. And it wouldn't remotely surprise me if after Julian Nagelsmann and Germany participate in the Euros, Nagelsmann goes back to club football. There's a Germany vacancy. And I think it is a very realistic possibility that Klopp is the lead candidate to be Germany manager for the 2026 World Cup.
Yeah, that's going to be a fascinating thing. And like I said earlier, bittersweet, but it's going to be interesting to have an open spot in the Premier League for a new manager to come in, whether that's somebody that we've already seen or somebody new coming from outside. Like I said earlier, he's been around for a long time. And so it's going to be one of those where you don't see managers last very long these days in the roles. So very, very fascinating. But if you're a Chelsea fan and a Chelsea listener, I want to transition into maybe a transfer update, Ben, on the Chelsea side. There's a lot of rumors going on. By this time last year, we'd already spent about 100 million, and we went to deadline day and spent another 100 and so million to get Enzo. It's been relatively quiet on the Chelsea side. And believe me, as a Chelsea fan, I'm kind of pleased by this because my heart couldn't take too much more drama. But I am hearing some connections. I'm hearing some links. Victor Osimhen's name has been dropped many, many times. Karim Benzema is one they've talked about on loan. I'm hearing about strikers from Aston Villa. Broya might be leaving the club. What can you share with us as to what's going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, I think it's been a quiet window. Quiet windows are not always a bad thing. If you're a well-run club and if you've spent significantly over the course of the last few windows, you would expect a quiet window. And remember, January, it's a seller's market. So it can be quite tough for buyers. And at this stage in Chelsea's project, both financially speaking and in terms of quality, if you can't find the right target, you don't move, because it might be at the expense of being able to buy the right target instead in the summer. So Chelsea are not in a position where they need to panic buy or add players for the sake of it, at least not senior ones anyway. And what I sense is that they're going to put most of their eggs in the Osimhen basket to at least give that one a go. And that's why there's maybe a caution about bringing in another striker now, at least a high-value one. And it's hard if you're going for younger names, because everyone knows Chelsea are going to go big for a striker in the summer. And big for a striker in the summer because they've realised this window that the right kind of profile is not available now. And then, because you've got Nicholas Jackson at the club as well, and at the moment, Broya too, they probably have a challenge showing a younger striker where their minutes are going to lie. And it maybe doesn't even help that a few players have gone out on loan. It hasn't succeeded for whatever reasons, not always Chelsea's fault. And then back they come. So now everyone's seen a few windows of the project and they've sort of seen what works and what doesn't work and what pathways have materialized and what haven't materialized and who's broken through and who hasn't and who's still too young to break through, but will break through. So everyone from Chelsea's academy to young players they've got to young targets, John Duran at Villa, unfortunately injured, but a good example. They'll be looking at Chelsea and they might think great contract, great money, but is there enough precedent from what the new ownership have done to suggest that the game time is there? And if it isn't, they may not want to join. And I think that's been an issue with Antonio Nusa dating back to last summer. The player's quite smart. He's very considered. And you'll find even with Brentford, who are expected to sign him, he wants to go back to Bruges first because he wants to make sure that he gets game time. So it's not just about what Chelsea want. It's about who's available in the market at the right price. And it's about convincing that player. And I think that this window, they've really only had one choice, which is to buy short-term and old, or to buy young and long-term. But that in between of the right profile at the right age for the now is not really available. And this is why they'll turn their attention likely to Victor Osimhen, less likely to Ivan Toney. Victor Gyökeres is maybe someone that they will reconsider, although there's been no interest in January and reports of an 85 million euros bid are incorrect, to my understanding. And Benjamin Sesko might be another option. So Chelsea could even sign two. It wouldn't surprise me if they go for a sort of Sesko-type player and an Osimhen-type player, because there's a very realistic chance that Broya either goes in the next few days or certainly by the summer. And then they would have the opportunity to bring in not one, but two. So the quietness is because Chelsea need a striker. And if they can't get the right striker, maybe it's better to get no striker at all. Without goings, Broya will have to wait and see. I think that Chelsea are going to have to come down on the top end of their price, that sort of 50 million number you may hear. But I've always kind of been told that it's 35 million and up. So if someone bids 35 million or maybe offers a loan with an obligation. Still a possibility. Fulham are one to watch. Maybe Villa. I think Wolves think the price is too high. West Ham's interest was historical. When they made the bid for Broja, it was 33 million. So again, that gives you a kind of ballpark for estimation. But I don't think anybody's going to be dropping 40, 50, 60 million on Amanda Broja at the moment, because he's fresh back from injury and he hasn't proven himself yet this season to be a consistent goal scorer. Conor Gallagher less likely to go in the next few days, but you just never know, because if Tottenham decide to move, if Højbjerg was to leave, they might try their luck. And we have to wait and see. So it's a complicated situation. Time is running out. And even though Chelsea want a couple of outgoings and maybe one incoming, there's no guarantees at this point, because we're getting to that stage of the window where there's no point in Chelsea doing anything that they either think can be delayed until the summer, and that's Broja and that's Gallagher, or Chelsea buying somebody only to realise that it was a waste of money because the options available weren't good enough, but they wanted something for the sake of something. So instead, you wait until summer, and that's when you can attack Osimhen. That's when you can attack, if they choose to, Tony. That's when, if they want to reignite any interest, they can move for Gyökeres. And in addition to that, somebody like Evan Ferguson may be available as well. So you've got four names there that are probably better than any four names now that are available, but you cannot buy now. I would potentially even add Rafa Leão back into the mix as well. But again, right now, he's got 175 million release clause. So that's five names that probably every Chelsea fan would get quite excited about, most of them anyway. None of them are available now. So why spend 20, 30, 40, 50 million now on someone just for the sake of numbers that, one, you might regret, and two, might mean that you don't have that 40 or 50 million or whatever the number is to then put towards the other names that I mentioned, most of which are in excess of 80 million if you're going to stand any chance of succeeding. And again, that's why I think that we've had a quiet January from Chelsea as far as striker incomings are concerned.
Yeah, and like I said at the beginning of the segment, Ben, I think for me at least as a Chelsea fan, it's been difficult to understand and watch our transfer business. And I think with it being a quiet January, it's almost helpful to see the club sit back and try and study the market and decide what they want to do rather than just kind of go on the shotgun approach. We talked about that last year when we had this discussion. So this year, I'm pleased. I know a lot of Chelsea fans are screaming for a striker, but like you've said, hopefully summer is the time we're looking at that position. Ben, I have one more question that I want to talk to you about, and it might not even be what you know, it might be your opinion, but what is the feeling or your feeling with Clearly Capital and Mauricio Pochettino? Things haven't gone necessarily to plan, but in my opinion, they haven't gone horrible like we saw in the previous management that we've had. What's your feeling, or what's the news in and around so far Pochettino half season through?
Well, I think that Pochettino is always going to be judged in the summer. That's the halfway point of the guaranteed contract. It's a 3-year contract, but 2 years guaranteed and then 1 year optional. So it's natural that fans are looking more at results and are used to this Abramovich cutthroat mentality. But I think Clear Lake Capital actually gave Graham Potter even more time than Abramovich would have done. Abramovich, for me, might have even sacked Potter after the Newcastle loss heading into the World Cup, but certainly immediately after the Spurs loss and definitely after the home loss, I think it was, to Southampton. So you can kind of understand why the fan base are on edge, but I think Chelsea have scored twice as many goals as under Graham Potter. They've got more points. They're not that far off sixth place. They're in a cup final, all without really a flagship striker, but we should pay some respect to Nicholas Jackson because he has got goals, and all with a bunch of injuries. So it's sort of a strange one, because how do you judge Pochettino when half of his starting lineup are not available to him and a star summer striker is likely to arrive? And that's the kind of craziness of it all. I was looking a few weeks ago, I think it was the game against maybe Preston, or if it wasn't Preston, it was possibly the league game against Luton, because, you know, like Chilwell's come back now. But I think it was that game. against Luton, maybe. And it was Petrovic in goal, who I think is the number one at the moment, but you could argue he wasn't bought as the number one. So you still have to say technically Sanchez is missing. You had Gusto at right back and James is missing. You had Colwill at left back, who thankfully now has played a couple of games at centre back, but he's out of position. You have Silva, who's likely to leave the club at the end of the season. And you have De Sassi, who I don't think will be a starting centre back when Wesley Fofana is fit. Then you had Conor Gallagher and Moises Caicedo. I think the challenge with Gallagher is that he will lose that midfield spot to Enzo Fernandez if Fernandez and Caicedo are fit, and maybe even Lavia over time. And I don't think he plays further forwards because the only option is centrally, and you've got Cole Palmer and Christopher Nkunku. So unless Nkunku leads the line, then Palmer to play further forwards in a 4-2-3-1, Gallagher to play further forwards in a 4-2-3-1 can't really take that spot. And then I think in that game you had like Jackson, Madueke and Broyer, and you could say, well, Madueke might not be a starter, Broyer might not be a starter. You got Chilwell missing, you've got James missing. In that game you had Enzo Fernando missing, you got Nkunku missing. You've probably bring in Fofana. And you'll probably sign a flagship striker. So that sort of summed up the season for me, because virtually every starting lineup, I know everyone will have different ideas, but five or six that I would put in have never really been in Pochettino's starting lineup, either because Chelsea have had injuries or alternatively because they haven't yet managed to sign the player that we all know that they're going to sign in the next window or two. Yeah. So when you add all of that up, if Chelsea finished the season with a League Cup trophy and European football, or even if they lose the League Cup final and get Europa League by finishing in the top six, they might only be one player, because we'll have had another half a season of experience for all these youngsters. They might only be one player short, one goal scorer short. And it's sort of staggering on the one hand, because if you're going to spend $1 billion, how have you not already got that goal scorer? But okay, let's forget that and look ahead to the summer. And again, judge Pochettino then. So I think what will happen is that, as planned on day one during his interview, I think the aim was always to appraise Pochettino at the halfway point of the guaranteed part of his contract. And then I think there'll be no excuses, because the younger players will have had a second half. Chelsea will know where they're at the back half of this season. They'll have hopefully built some momentum. They'll hopefully be taking more big chances. They'll have strengthened again in the summer window. And then I think it will be slightly more cutthroat, because you've almost got 10, 15 games if you're Pochettino heading towards December. And then if Chelsea are not top four, then if Chelsea are not pushing, then if Chelsea are not doing what Chelsea traditionally do, which is always being up there and contending, then I think you can't use these P words like patience, project, progress, because the indication from Chelsea sources has always been this is a four window plan. Yep. And summer 2024 will be the fourth window. So what they're essentially saying is that it goes the crazy January that they had into summer, into this January, into summer. And they're discounting that first window because they accept that there wasn't a recruitment team built. So that summer 2024 will be the fifth window, but the fourth of four in this four window plan. So then there's no excuses, because you can't say the players are inexperienced or haven't had time to bed in. If you've not changed the manager, you can't say instability. If you've had a bunch of injuries, you've had time for players to get fit. If the injuries still keep coming, you've got to look into it internally to find out why. You really can't make any more excuses.
Yeah.
So words like project, patience, progress, I think all go out the window. And I think it will be on the other P, Pochettino, to get a significant start to the season if he is backed in the summer market. Otherwise, we will be putting more scrutiny, and so will the owners on the manager. But right now, I think his job isn't under any imminent threat. And the beauty in many ways for Pochettino is if he can get to a situation where he wins the League Cup, then he's got Europe by the end of February. So then it gives Chelsea the opportunity to not relax as far as the league position is concerned, but given they're unlikely to get Champions League football, maybe experiment a bit, maybe breed in a bit more young talent. So that might mean Silva gets a few less games. That might mean Alfie Gilchrist gets a few more minutes, etc. And I think that can be very useful. So I think we're not going to see any drama in the second half of the season regarding another managerial change, unless he obviously loses game after game after game. And I think that's smart, because if it's a full window plan, you have to see out your full window plan, and you have to take the criticism, and you have to take the distaste from certain parts of the Chelsea fan base, and you have to stick to your strategy. But if at the end of the full window plan, the strategy doesn't work, then it's obviously a different story.
Yeah. Ben, this has been so fascinating. It's been exciting to hear you talk, especially the last few minutes. From a Chelsea perspective, it's very interesting to hear the four-window plan. I know that we've always heard about it and we've known that the ownership wants to do something, but it gives us something to look forward to. So very, very happy to have you on here. Thank you so much for being on here. You are at JacobsBen on Twitter and at BenDavidJacobs on Instagram. I've seen you post a lot more on Instagram. Very exciting to see all the updates there as well. Any final thoughts before we part ways?
No, I think it's just going to be an exciting few days at the end of the window. Always drama, always surprises. Remember, Cole Palmer was a surprise. Yep. So Chelsea could yet pull a rabbit out of a hat. But I think that it will be a quieter window. But that's not to say that we won't get a late twist.
You've heard it here first. Ben, thank you so much. And everyone listening, thank you so much for tuning in. You can find us at the Premier Chelsea Pod on Instagram and other places. We are on all Spotify, Apple Music, all of those things. So please give us a listen and give us a review. Thanks, everybody. Goodbye.
The Premier Chelsea has partnered with FuboTV. FuboTV is your home for live sports and TV without a cable in the US and Canada. You can watch on all your devices, which means you don't have to miss any of the actions or goals that Chelsea score in the Premier League and Champions League.
You heard that right. FuboTV networks broadcast Premier League, Champions League, and many other leagues and tournaments. So what are you waiting for? Start your free trial today at FuboTV.com/TPC.